The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to animator J.J. Settlemyer. You know his work, even if you don't know his name. Saturday TV Funhouse, The Ex-Presidents, and The Ambiguously Gay Duo were all concepts he spun out for Saturday Night Live with Robert Smigel. He also did Tech Jansen for Stephen Colbert, Beavis and Butthead for Mike Judge and MTV, and Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law for Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Stick around. This conversation is coming at you in four brilliant colors. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of sweaty cartoon characters, all hoping to be next in line for the J.J. Settlemyer treatment in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. This year's 40th anniversary of NBC's Saturday Night Live became a time to reflect back on so many great characters that came out of that show over four decades. Roseanne Roseanna Dana, Stefan, the Blues Brothers, Father Guido Sarducci, and the Ambiguously Gay Duo. My guest today, J.J. Settlemyer, teamed up with comedy writer Robert Smigel to create Gary and Ace, the ever-curious, ever-in-denial, ambiguously gay duo. What most of us didn't know for a long time was that the animated segment was voiced by Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert. Now, that cartoon was part of an irreverent series called Saturday TV Funhouse. Who could ever forget hearing Lorne Michaels in his Canadian way snap, "Come back with my show!" As the ex-presidents, fun with real audio, animated outtakes, and the duo unspooled over several seasons. Settlemyer, who once dreamed not of being an animator, but of a career in comic books, was also present at the birth of Mike Judge's Beavis and Butthead for MTV, Tech Jansen for The Colbert Report, Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law for Cartoon Network's Adult Swim, and The Big Adventures of Little Sean and Gus for USA Network's long-running series, Psych. His studio, co-founded and operated with his wife, Patrice, also has a strong commercial portfolio, including design and animation work for national clients as diverse as NBC Sports, Adidas, Scrubbing Bubbles, and Alka-Seltzer. Curiously, JJ and I have been Facebook friends for years, although we never actually met in person until he was pointed out in the audience of a presentation I gave on the career of Will Eisner in March at Wizard World in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was excited to meet this legendary animator in the flesh and begged him to be a guest here. And what do you know? J.J. Settlemyer, welcome to Mr. Media.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here, and no begging necessary. No, it's a pleasure. Right. I love talking about myself.
And I'll save the begging for my wife. Thank you. All right, so I actually want to start, of all places, with Will Eisner, because I noticed in my research that you and he have both had lived in White Plains, possibly at the same time, and I wondered if you guys had ever met.
Well, that's one of the big regrets that I have, is that I never got to really – I got to meet him when he and Jules Pfeiffer were doing a thing at Cooper Union years ago. But it was only because I knew Jules and I could go up and say hello to Jules that I actually got to say hi to Will. But I would have loved to have been able to, you know, spend some time around him. I have – I mean, Jules Pfeiffer is a friend. Dennis Kitchen is a friend. You're a friend now, whether you want to be or not. And so it's and Will's work – has been such an inspiration and influence to me that I only found out after I had been in White Plains that he lived in White Plains. A lot of cartoonists and artists lived up here. I mean, Jack Davis lived in Scarsdale, and for years we lived in Scarsdale as well. And actually, I got a call at one point about 15 years ago from this guy named Dick Ayers, who wanted to just come over and say hello. So I got to be friends with Dick Ayers, who lived in White Plains as well, but never really got to hang with Will, and kills me. Oh. His work is just amazing, and again, like I say, will always be an inspiration, luckily, but would have loved to have met him and spoken with him.
Now, I was going to ask you and about if he had influenced you, because I don't see it, but I'm sure it's there.
It has to do with his stuff. I made a transition from kind of superheroes into actually reading comics. Before Will, and before I got turned on by Will's stuff, I didn't really read comics. I used to look at them. I used to love the covers. And what's also interesting is the first book I ever asked for was The Great Comic Book Heroes by Jules Pfeiffer. So I was 8, and, you know, I'm going through this book, and my father was a strong inspiration in terms of comic books, because he read comic books as a kid. His mother kept all his comic books. So I grew up reading his comic books, which he still has, which are still like mile high condition, just beautiful, beautiful.
Wow.
And so I'm going through The Great Comic Book Heroes, and I'm seeing The Flash, I'm seeing Superman and Batman and all this stuff. And then I get to the end, and there's this spirit guy. And I said to my father, who's this? Who's the spirit? And he kind of looked at me and said, you know, just wait. The spirit is someone that is kind of a dull, you won't really get into it. Well, sure enough, when the Warren things came out in 74, and I was just finishing high school and about to go to college, I got that issue, and then I was just totally hooked. The layout, the staging, the storytelling, the drawing, I'd never seen anything like it. So I just gobbled up everything I possibly could, and I think when it comes to where you might see it is in some of the print stuff I've done, and in some of the comic illustration I've done. Eisner, Mad Magazine, those are where the influences start to show a little bit. But I move around a lot with my drawing style and design, and there are a lot of spots that I've designed that the studio has produced in animation that you would never know the same person did it, because I'm very flexible and nimble. That's, in other words, what I'm saying is I'm a graphic dilettante. So, but it's great being able to, you know, move around, and when there's a style that's necessary, I can either work with an artist or I can develop it myself, and that's been very handy.
So you're very Zelig-like.
I'm very Zelig-like. I do hide. It's interesting because people know us from the SNL stuff because of the title card, which was an absolute, you know, gift from the gods to have that and a credit list in the middle of such a popular, visible show. But you know, people really wouldn't know our work on television unless it was something that we had done releases about, or perhaps it's in the style that now has become known as a Saturday Night Live style.
Yeah, it's you know, it's very nice to have that commercial in the middle of a 90-minute you know, program that's being seen by adults who, by the way, may run, you know, ad agencies or be movie producers or.
And the title card itself wasn't a part of our involvement from the very beginning. The title card itself came from. I think it was like in the middle of the second season, and we only did the first three seasons exclusively. We always did the Ambiguously Gay Duo, but it was very hard to continue and do all of those cartoons continuously after that because the budgets were very low, and the they're all consuming. You know, it's but they're totally worth doing. But in the middle of the second season, we had done a storyboard for a project, but then it was killed, and we invoiced for having the work, having done the work that we did, but the policy had changed at the network, and they weren't paying for upfront work like that anymore. And so I said, well, if you're not going to pay for it, then I want a title card like Robert, which Robert was cool with. And there was this – you could hear over the telephone this kind of – I don't say it's relief, but that was like no problem to them. That was like, oh, whatever, you know. It changed our life completely just to have that up there for, you know, a second and a half. But it was interesting. I learned about branding too, because there were plenty of people who were convinced that's all we did. And here we had this incredible wealth of graphic vocabulary we had worked in for all these commercials we had done. And that's another one of the reasons that we stopped doing it, is to try to get on a campaign to kind of let people know that we were more than SNL. But it was what a wonderful collection of work. And it helped change people's perception of what animation was supposed to be. You know, between things like Beavis and South Park and The Simpsons, suddenly and all the stuff that MTV was doing prior to that with their little IDs, this all helped, you know, change something that was for kids and ducks and bunnies into something that was now a very interesting, effective tool.
Well, so help me with the timeline here. What was the first big breakthrough for you as an animator? When did you, you know, really get – what came before the Dana Carvey show, for example?
Well, what really helped – what was really my big break was working – before Patrice and I opened the studio, working for another studio and with another fella called Aro Bleckman. He was – is a brilliant graphic designer, illustrator, and he had a studio called the Ink Tank. And working at the Ink Tank was different than working at all the other cartoon studios, because the Ink Tank didn't really do cartoons. They did animation. And it sounds snooty, because it is.
Well, it's different.
And there's a certification. Yeah. And it's working. That's where I also got to meet, you know, these brilliant illustrators and designers like Seymour Quast and Charles Slackman and Ed Sorrell and all these amazing people who weren't known for working in animation, but their style was translatable and it was offering the market a spin on the craft that it hadn't really had, which is really also a very New York thing too. New York is kind of anti-formula and is inspired by all of the print stuff and publishing that's been going on here. That's how, I mean, animation started in New York. So working at the Ink Tank had a big influence on me. And then we'd only been open about a year and a half when the people that we already knew at MTV, because I had worked on the IDs and I had worked with them while I was at the Ink Tank, The guy who represents us in New York, Andy Arkin, had also known the people over there, and he heard about this thing that they wanted to try to do because it was on Liquid TV, which was a show back then that was done by Colossal Pictures, another studio, great studio. And they had evidently this clip, this cartoon done by this guy named Mark Judge had garnered all this response. And they actually did some focus group testing on the Beavis thing because it was kind of showing a lot of attention. And it turned out to be this kind of Three Stooges thing where guys liked it. Girls didn't really care for it, except in New Jersey. And I know it sounds like
– Those are my people, those New Jerseyites.
Yeah. It's I don't know if it's the water or whatever. But and so by early 92, we started talking with them about doing this thing. And by – it was actually the same day my son was born in 1992 that we signed the contract to do the first season. And we did 120 minutes in about 6 months. And the model sheets were being done as we were producing the cartoons. It was really something else.
Well, and I heard Mike Judge talk about that, the early days of Beavis and Butthead. I think he was on Mark Maron's WTF podcast explaining about how – I guess originally he had done literally everything himself.
Yep.
The writing, the voices, the animation. Yep. And he had just done samples, and then he did a little longer, and then it just took off, and he was literally unprepared for – he didn't have the capacity to produce – mass produce the stuff the way it needed to be done.
It was interesting too because he had done all his cartoons himself. Milton, which is my favorite, which is the guy who's going to burn the place down because the guy keeps taking the stapler. It's Office – it's Office Space before Office Space.
Right.
And they got Mike and they moved him and his family from Texas to here in Port Chester, put him up in a condo, and he would come here and look at models and review stuff here at the studio in White Plains, and then shoot into the city for storyboard meetings and voice records at Sync Sound, and then he'd go home and then start the day again all over again. And he did, again, most of the voices, if not all, in most of the episodes. It was incredible. It was really incredible. I found there was this struggle that we had, though, because what I loved about Beavis was the fact that it looked like they did it. It looked like Beavis and Butthead did the cartoon production. It looked like the drawings that you see on the inside of a math textbook or something. And I think Mike at a certain point was trying to get the drawing to be a little bit better. I didn't want the drawing to be better. And we spent a lot of time getting into the style and into his drawing to try to keep it, especially with the hands, to keep it as crude and also with the sensibility that a kid or an inexperienced person has, which means if you don't need the hands, they're like this thalidomide appendage that just kind of hangs there. If they're doing air guitar, all of a sudden every knuckle and every finger is, showing. And it was great. I did find after MTV took it over and it started going into mass production and they started farming it out as well. The hands – animators don't like to spend a lot of time struggling with the drawing of hands. They're very hard. Once you get it and know how to throw in, fingers and – It's a relief to be able to do that. But Beavis needed to look like it was done on the fly. And I think Mike would have liked it to have been better drawn at a certain point.
Well, he later got that with King of the Hill. He got
Yeah. But the guy's you can tell he looks at people, he hears people, he understands social stuff really well. And the way he spits it out, it's fabulous. It's just really, fantastic.
Was it fun to work around him or was it just nonstop work? It must have been intense.
It was fun. Look, MTV had never done any animation before where they were really involved. Colossal did Liquid TV, and they would acquire pre-existing, you know, media and material and use it, as well as produce some new stuff. But MTV had never done stuff before. We had never done a series before. In fact, I kind of found out afterwards, after we had kind of negotiated everything and we got everything signed, I started talking to people over the course of when we were actually doing the production at different studios. And this thing had bounced around the industry a lot. We were essentially just, you know, the only idiots who were who were stupid enough to take it on. We didn't know better. So it was that got it done, and it was fun, and it was exciting seeing it air and get all this feedback. But after a while, the fun stuff is in the developing, and when that goes away, and we've learned this overall, it's the grueling task of manufacturing the stuff isn't as fun as the development and the sculpting and the pre-production and the pilot. You know, it's so the series type stuff we don't really get into and continue through all that well. So that's that. But it was fun and it was exciting, very very and important. It was like the last thing that the industry needed to kind of propel it into, I don't know what animation is anymore. It's just, you know, it's great. And MTV took it and with their animation block did some really nice stuff.
So you did the first season of Beavis and Butthead, and then where do you go from there?
Then right after Beavis, we went into doing the resurrection of Schoolhouse Rock, actual Schoolhouse Rock stuff, which was wonderful too, because the stuff is beautifully designed. It's got a great sensibility. People have this fondness for it. I mean, you say Conjunction Junction in probably any elevator and the whole thing will just break out into song, you
What's
know?
Your function?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then at the end of that, there's a guy at Saturday Night Live, Jim Signorelli, who was the director and produced all of the live action commercial parodies. And he and I had known each other for a while and had talked about doing something together. I always wanted to do a takeoff of like the Lucky Charm spot and see maybe something could go terribly wrong with that or whatever. And he sent over a board or an idea that had come from this Robert Smigel guy called Cluckin' Chicken, which is a takeoff on a fast food chicken restaurant that had this animated mascot. Eventually he gets his head cut off and it becomes this visceral going terribly wrong thing that was just, you know, fantastic to be able to have on a commercial reel. You know, it was Saturday Night Live. It was funny. It was a takeoff on advertising. What more could you ask for? And, so that came after the Schoolhouse Rock stuff, but the production of that was very iffy. Robert and I didn't get along very well, and because it was before digital animation. We were doing everything on cell, and once you made a decision, you had to really stick with it, and it was very complicated. But the spot was great. And throughout all this entire period, we're doing commercials. About a year and a half later, the Conan show started up, and Robert called us in to do the titles for Conan's show. And from then on, we kind of stayed in touch, and the Dana Carvey show came after that, and that's where the Ambiguously Gay Duo started. And he took the ideas of the idea of the cartoons to Lorne, and we just started doing these cartoons. There was no structure. There was no contract. Let's try this. Let's try that. By the second season, we decided to try to give it a responsible structure as much as we could. And that's when we had an actual contract. So by the early 96 was the Dana Carvey show. And from that point on, until 2000, 2001, we were doing the SNL stuff with Robert. And, you know, and again, like I said, all these, all the while commercials are being done. Harvey Birdman came at about 2000, at the end of 2000, was the beginning of Adult Swim. We had also done this stuff called Captain Linger, which we did about 8 episodes of Captain Linger, which is a one of my favorite, actually. He's a totally clueless superhero. And we did it. And initially, Stuart Hill, the guy who had the idea for it at Cartoon, wanted to do it in a Rocky and Bullwinkle, J. Ward, Bill Scott style, which I got, and it sounded good initially. But then I started thinking about it, and the opportunity to really get awkward and uncomfortable and un-cartoon animation with it started to present itself, because Stuart's writing is just fantastic. It's very down home. It's very he really, again, understands people and lingo. And so I brought up the idea of doing, what if we did it like a Kurt Swan drawing, which is, I love Kurt Swan. I mean, but it's nostalgia that makes me love Kurt Swan. His drawing, I think, is beautifully adequate. Nothing more.
We need to point out, for people who don't know who you're talking about, Kurt Swan was the Superman artist in the comic books for DC from the 60s. It was kind of
80s, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was iconic for Superman. If you saw Superman in that period of time, that was Kurt Swan. That was almost Kurt Swan. So I'm
Superman,
sorry.
Jimmy Olsen.
Yep.
The drawing, beautifully done, but just adequate. Not a real robust, strong style. And so once you put that on once you pair that up with a cartoon, people don't know what to expect. If it's Rocky and Bullwinkle, they're going to go, it looks silly. It's something funny is going to happen. You know, it's not just going to be this boring, mundane, whatever. And it just worked like a charm. I mean, you can hear people squirm because the guy just has no clue. He can save the day, but then he doesn't know what to do afterwards. And it's just plain awkward. And so that and Harvey Birdman were being done at the same time, and kind of was part of the launch of Adult Swim.
All right, now I want to take you back a minute, though, because we in one breath we jump past what I think was a pretty important error for you. You did what will always be known as the short-lived Dana Carvey show.
Yes.
It's always referred to that way. But that show that actually had a being involved with Ambiguously Gay Duo for that show, that had a huge impact on your career down the line, right?
It did. And the show itself was terrific.
Right.
Robert called and said he had this script for a superhero type cartoon. Could he send it over? And it was the first time I've ever laughed out loud at a script. I've read scripts where I can see the humor in it and maybe what I can do with it and what we can do to, you know, make it terrific and everything. But this was just plain hilarious. And I was laughing by myself alone in my room. And the rest of the studio was kind of perplexed as to what was going on there. It was I love comic books. To be able to not just do an animated cartoon based on a comic book thing, but to make fun of them and to do something like this was just extraordinary. And I also had to I had to understand immediately that the idea was they aren't gay, that everyone else is, you know, it's the homophobic thing that's driving the thing. And
wait, are you declaring now and for all time that they were not gay?
Absolutely.
No, come on.
Yes, absolutely.
Gary and Ace, not gay.
What's everybody looking at? Nothing. Yeah. because if they're gay, That's not half as fun as if they're not and everyone else is freaking out.
And what about the guys, the voice actors on that? I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Stephen Colbert is Ace, and Steve Carell is Gary. Once you know it's Stephen Colbert, you can't not hear him. Steve Carell is doing a voice, so it's actually very funny when you think that that's Steve Carell. Robert does Big Head. And often what they would do is also incorporate the guest into the voices for the script. But yeah, we ended up doing, I think all said and done, we did 11 of them, and they were great. And I never heard a bad word from anybody about them. No, it just everybody seems to love them.
And you obviously you had worked out your earlier issues with Robert Smigel to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really what it was the way SNL works is the writers produce their own stuff. And if you've never done animation before, you don't know what's involved, and you're being given the responsibility. Look, if you're going to fall on your ass, it's going to be your responsibility. He has a definitive vision, and if he can't get it, it's going to be frustrating. Or if he's already made a decision to go in one direction and he's got to change, it's going to be frustrating for us because of the crap. Once Digital Ink and Paint came in, it was a lot easier. But that's not what saved it. What saved it was that I just understood really what was driving it. And I could always be assured of having a great piece of work at the end of any project that Robert and I did together. And that's what it's all about. There's nothing else after that.
So who owns the rights to all that stuff, the TV Funhouse stuff?
I believe SNL, or let's say Broadway Video.
Lorne Michaels' company.
Lorne Michaels' company. Initially, it was shared with Brillstein Gray because they did the Dana Carvey show. And then when the cartoons went over to SNL, Lorne ultimately, I think, owns everything. Don't quote me, but that's my impression. Is I think Robert has worked out a great deal where if they want to expand on them, whether it's Ace and Gary or the ex-presidents, he might even have a more of a hold on the ex-presidents than Ace and Gary. They involve him anyway. And what Robert does is when Ace and Gary comes in, like we've been doing some merchandise recently, and when stuff comes up with Ace and Gary, they call Robert, and then Robert calls me, and then I work with Broadway Video, and then we all kind of work together.
Is there any chance of seeing more? I mean, Ace and Gary are great, but I would love to see a longer The Ex-Presidents. I just think that is hysterical stuff.
The concept is always there because they're always going to be ex-presidents,
right?
But it's kind of I think it's kind of played itself out. Maybe something will happen, but I've never heard of anything getting developed beyond the cartoons that were done with the ex-presidents. I have heard of stuff, getting developed with Ace and Gary, but it didn't take off. And they did that wonderful piece with John Hamm and Jimmy Fallon that was live action. That was hilarious.
Oh, right. I remember
yeah.
that.
And then Stephen and Colbert played Brainio, and Carell played Big Head. But working with SNL has been, some of the most important work that we've done. And certainly, this consistent visibility that we were getting was fabulous too. And what it also did is, it set us, it hooked us into the whole community of people that we're at the Daily Show and Colbert. And so, and actually I went to the University of Wisconsin. A lot of people at the Daily Show and Colbert, went to Madison as well and worked at, Onion people that started in Madison as well. So
who else is in that group? Dennis Kitchen was a Wisconsin guy.
Ben Carlin, who was the executive producer of
the Daily Show.
Daily Show and the Colbert Report at the same time at a certain point. He was part of that. Rich Dom, who was the head writer, was from Madison. Dennis Kitchen, I just saw him two nights ago at the thing at Columbia that was done. And we've known each other for quite a few years, but I had no idea how much was going on in Madison when I was in Madison. And it friggin' kills me.
Yeah. It's always like that, right?
Oh, God.
All right, so I'm keeping one eye on the clock because there's a bunch of more things I want to ask you about.
Okay.
I know we had talked about having you show us around, but I think we're going to stick to a conversation for today, and maybe we'll get to come back another time and we can see
sure.
the facility there a little bit.
And I'll try to stay within my mortise here.
Oh, you're good. You're good. one of the things that the Dana Carvey show eventually led to, as you mentioned, is the Colbert Report, where you did Tech Jansen, Stephen Colbert's alter ego. How many of those were actually done, and what was Stephen's involvement, if any?
Actually, what happened with having done the Dana Carvey show and the relationship with Colbert, it went from there to us doing the titles for Strangers with Candy,
oh,
which was Colbert and
that was UCB, wasn't it?
Sedaris and kind of.
Sedaris, right.
Sedaris and Colbert and Dinello, very close friends. Paul Dinello, very close friends, and they've done stuff both for air and on stage together for years. So we went to Strangers with Candy, and then we also did a thing for The Daily Show that was a Schoolhouse Rock takeoff that Stephen was involved in. The Tech Jansen thing was, I think we did six of them. And then Flickr Lab did like two or three after us, but it was a more of a cartoony look to it. Tech started as a concept that Stephen was kind of pseudo plugging with this kind of, you know, unabridged Webster's Dictionary thickness book that he had. And when they decided they wanted to take a shot at doing some animation with it, they just kind of explained it to me, and we did all the design and all the animation production. Originally, when it looked like it might be more involved and they might have had a bigger budget, we were actually going to make his pompadour kind of like what Robin is to Batman. It was going to have its own personality that he was going to interact with. But and then the idea of making it letterboxed was this kind of self-important, pompous sort of approach, bigger than life sort of stuff. And so the idea was, you know, this is obviously Stephen is Tech, or the Stephen Colbert character is Tech. So he's this pompous,
right,
you know, Mr. Know-it-all. And I tried to apply the same thing to even the title card. If I had to design the worst design title card in the world, this is what it would look like. Terrible use of type and so forth. But again, fun stuff to be involved in. Stephen was very involved. Everybody there was very involved. All the writers, and I think there were six of them, all had equal participation in it. So we'd have story meetings over there, usually very early in the morning before the show kind of took off. And they were just starting to hit. Mm-hmm. So corralling all of them together was very important, but very hard to do. And they were all very involved in it. And it was great.
Have you gotten any sense of whether you'll see any work with Stephen on his new show or as he moves over to the Late Show?
I would love to, but haven't gotten any sense. Nobody knows what's going on over there. We actually also designed the piece at the end of the Colbert Report with the Spartina, the bird.
Yeah,
we did that as well. So we've been doing stuff with Stephen for quite a while. So hopefully when something comes up, we can stay involved. But it's a great group. And he's actually terrific. Really a great guy, too.
Well, there's one thing this conversation has shown me. It's that I need twice as much time to talk to you about your career. We talked about doing so many things. You were going to walk us around and show us.
Right.
And unfortunately, we're just going to run out of time. I did want to ask you, I know it's hard to talk about projects that you're currently working on.
Mm-hmm.
What is – you do a lot of commercial work. I mentioned a lot of that in the introduction. What is more satisfying? Is it the shows that we've talked about, the serial type of things, or is it commercials? And is it because one pays better than the other, which I suspect is the commercials?
We're at a point, and I'm at a point now, where I don't want to work on anything that's not going to be satisfying. So That being said, yeah, okay, commercials are supposed to pay more. But if I don't do a good job, or if I do something that I can't promote because it's not up to what I think it should have been, it doesn't matter how much it pays, because it's going to do us more harm than good. It's right now, it's pretty equal. I mean, the stuff that we do and that I do, it doesn't matter whether it's broadcast. It doesn't matter whether it's TV broadcast or a commercial or a festival, film festival opening. I'm looking for an opportunity to do stuff that's going to use animation correctly, that's going to give me an opportunity to play and have fun, and show people something maybe they haven't seen before. And I really love to collaborate. So if I can get involved with artists or cartoonists or designers, illustrators, and translate their style into animation, I love to do that.
Okay.
So there's no favorite way or realm to work in, because every realm we've worked in, we've been able to have fun in and, you know, do good stuff in. So I just try to find some way of getting those projects in.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can order a copy. We've been talking a lot about Saturday TV Funhouse here. You can actually order the best of Saturday TV Funhouse, created by my guest, J.J. Seidelmeyer, and comedy writer Robert Smigel, by clicking on the DVD cover. Just if you're watching this on MrMedia.com, either left or right under the video, you'll see the cover for Best of TV Funhouse. Click on that. You can order it from Amazon and have it pretty darn quick, and that way you can relive all those great moments we've been talking about. And you can find out more about the work of J.J. Seidelmeyer at his company's website, jjseidelmeyer.com. It's jjseidelmeyer.com. So that's the website. I know you're on Facebook. Are you on Twitter as well?
I'm on Twitter, Instagram. Twitter is J.J. Seidelmeyer, and Instagram. I haven't done as much Instagramming. But Twitter and Facebook, the Facebook studio page is the place to go for, because that's where most of the stuff gets posted.
Okay. Well, JJ, great to talk to you. I just wish I had locked you up for 2 hours instead of one, but thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. This was great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show from the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.